And now on FM, we've our Book of the Week. Rebecca Front continues reading from Curious, her collection of anecdotes and yarns that explore the quirks and idiosyncrasies of human nature. Today, she examines her own personal relationship with fear.
The train plunges into a tunnel, and I begin to count. One, two, three, four. It's a futile attempt to gain control. If I'm prepared, if I know, for example, that heading out of King's Cross there are four 12-seconders, one after the other, or that just outside Grantham there's a 20-seconder, then maybe I can relax in the knowledge that it won't take long before we're out in the daylight again. But it doesn't work. All that happens is that the tunnels become the focus of my journey, the only things I can think about. I know all this is illogical, but that doesn't make much difference, because the real place I'm trapped in is not the walls of the tunnel or the shell of the train. No, the real place I'm trapped in is my head. I'm not scared of going into a tunnel. I'm scared of going into a panic. In Hilaire Belloc's cautionary tale, Jim, a little boy runs away from his scary nanny, only to get eaten by a lion. The moral of this story is, always keep a hold of nurse, for fear of finding something worse. My husband has a theory that I can cope with the nerve-wracking things particular to my life, the things that would induce anxiety in other people, by clinging on to little pockets of avoidable fear. I can, for example, take part in a debate with the Prime Minister, or be the only woman on a panel game, or appear on live TV, and be relatively relaxed about it. I just can't get the train home afterwards. A phobia is a way of controlling fear. But when you have to do the thing you've been avoiding, the fear starts controlling you. If you've never had a panic attack, then let me be the first to congratulate you. You've managed to avoid quite one of the most unpleasant experiences it's possible to have, while still, to the rest of the world, appearing to be doing nothing at all. I'll try to describe the symptoms. Hot flushes, cold shivers, a racing pulse, the inability to breathe, the feeling that you want to run but you can't move a muscle, nausea, dizziness. That'll do for starters. And it all comes over you in a wave in a matter of seconds. Sometimes completely out of the blue. When I get panic attacks, they're usually connected with something that I know might bring them on, being in an enclosed space or having some worry about my health, that sort of thing. For some unfortunate people, they come with no apparent cause at all. And here's the thing, once you've had one, the feeling is so overwhelmingly grim that you'll go to almost any lengths never to have one again. You start to avoid doing whatever you think might have triggered it. You become scared not of the thing itself, but of the feeling it induced in you. You're frightened of being frightened. Anxiety is like one of those Escher drawings of a bafflingly endless staircase. It goes round and round on itself, with no obvious way of getting off. Some years ago, I tweeted a reference to having panic attacks, and subsequently found myself described by journalists as bravely speaking out about my mental health issues. But the truth is, I don't think I have a mental health issue. To me, being anxious is perfectly normal. Okay, panic attacks are a little extreme, even for me, but I don't see why it's brave to write about them. Bravery suggests it's something I should be ashamed of, and I'm not. I'm not embarrassed about being neurotic, because I don't think I know a single person who would properly qualify as normal. I was sitting on a bus one day when a woman came down the stairs holding a rabbit on a lead. The rabbit was sizeable and had a pink bow in its fur. Its owner was young and soberly dressed, and on a scale of eccentricity, she'd definitely be nearer the end marked Rum Cove than the one marked Best Avoided. Nonetheless, as she staggered downstairs with this rabbit, all the other passengers decided she was probably a dangerous oddball. You could tell this because they turned their backs and pretended she wasn't there. Yet apart from the fact that the rabbit wasn't a dog, there was nothing odd in her behaviour at all. She stood an acceptable distance from her nearest fellow passengers, hung on sensibly to the rail with the hand that wasn't clutching her pet, and behaved in all respects like a woman carrying a shopping bag, rather than a camped-up, oversized bunny. And it was this very normality, I realised, that marked her out as strange. Here was someone self-confident enough to do something borderline weird and make no apology for it whatsoever. Another woman came down the stairs of the bus, spotted the rabbit, cooed a few niceties at its owner, and stroked its foot. The rabbit's, not the owner's. The latter was pleased, I think, not just that someone was admiring her pet, but that she was in some way being brought in from the cold. But then an odd thing happened. The second woman, though she'd stopped petting the rabbit, continued to stare at it. A stare that went on far, far too long. Slowly, the balance of normality shifted. The owner began to look uneasy as this seemingly normal woman gazed freakishly at her rabbit. Did she want to steal it? Was she planning to cook it? Her body tensed, her face hardened, and finally she did what all the other passengers had done to her. She turned her back and pretended the woman wasn't there. I have a friend who describes nearly everyone she meets as weird. For a long time, I used to think that maybe I'd missed some significant fact about them, because to me they seemed quite ordinary. But what she means by weird is different from me. My friend has created a level playing field on which those with neuroses are no odder than those with picky eating habits. They're all weird. I tend to think of mental health in much the same way as physical health. As far as I'm aware, there's no such thing as a perfect, flawless body. Even if you're super fit, you might get back problems or headaches. You could have spots at exactly the same time as having movie star good looks. If you also develop heart trouble or cancer or diabetes, okay, you've got a problem and you better get it seen to. The same is true of mental health. You may seem like the most well-adjusted, confident, successful person on the planet, but that doesn't mean you won't get depressed sometimes or be terrified of heights. If your mood swings or anxiety get so bad that you can no longer function, though, or if you're losing touch with reality or starting to be a danger to yourself or other people, yep, that's serious, and you definitely need some help. What I don't quite get is why those problems are considered embarrassing when cancer and heart trouble are not. It may be because mental illness is harder to diagnose, that there are wide parameters, so it's awkward knowing at what point you can say with certainty, that's depression all right, sure as eggs are eggs. But I think it's more complicated than that. I think it's to do with our atavistic fear of madness. When I was a child, everyone knew the name of their local asylum. It was constantly invoked as the worst place imaginable and as the place where you'd be carted off to if you didn't conform. I once visited an old-fashioned mental hospital shortly before it was closed down. There were long, dark corridors stretching into infinity, bars on the windows which were anyway too high up to see out of, people shouting and groaning randomly. It was terrifying. And if you weren't mad when you arrived there, you would be pretty soon afterwards. I'd gone there with a school singing group to perform an evening of music hall songs. Those poor patients. Just when they thought things couldn't get any worse, four do-gooding teenagers turned up to ta-ra-ra-bum-dee-ay the hell out of them. But I'll never forget the horror of that place, and I was only there for an hour or so. Given that all of us have a constant stream of curious, disconnected and sometimes distressing thoughts running through our brains, and that it's hard to know when those thoughts are just harmless electrical firings and when they've tipped over into something more disturbing, and given that for centuries if you went and asked for help, there was a fighting chance they'd lock you away in some hideous earthbound hell, you can start to see why people have tended not to want to talk about what's going through their minds. Many years ago, I was working in central London and had nipped out for a breath of air at lunchtime. Walking down one of the busiest shopping streets in the capital, I started to wonder why a particular woman had been walking quite so closely behind me for the last 10 minutes. Because I wasn't sure, and because it seemed like I was being, well, neurotic, I stopped to look in a shop window, assuming that she'd pass me. She didn't. She stopped too. Only she didn't look in the window. She looked at me, looking in the window. I glanced at her, thinking she'd look away, but like the woman on the bus staring at the rabbit, she just went right on peering at me. I repeated this action outside several further shops, and every time she did the same thing. There was no doubt about it. For some unfathomable reason, perhaps in a cloudy part of her psyche I reminded her of someone, or she just thought I needed keeping an eye on, she was following my every move, and she clearly wasn't going to stop. In broad daylight, in the middle of Covent Garden, I suddenly felt very afraid. I went into a shop, a tiny little one-roomed outlet for tights and scarves. I casually browsed the shelves, picking up multi-packs of pop socks and reading the washing instructions in exhaustive detail. But every time I peeped out of the window, she was there. Eventually, I knew I was going to have to ask for help. "Excuse me," I said to the young assistant. "I know this sounds a bit bizarre, but you see that woman out there? Well, I don't know why, but she's following me." The girl behind the counter looked outside. "Who is she?" she asked. "I don't know, that's the point. She's just been walking behind me for ages." "It's busy, though. I mean, there were probably a lot of people walking behind you," she said, as if to a dim-witted child. "Yes, I know that, but look at her, she's just standing there staring at me. They're not all doing that, are they?" "Well, I can't really get involved, I'm afraid," she said. "No," I explained, "I don't want you to sort her out or anything. I just thought perhaps if I disappeared, she might forget about me and move on." I realised as soon as I'd uttered it that disappeared was an unfortunate choice of word. With its connotations of witchcraft, I'd implied that I wanted some sort of spell performed. Weighing up the two participants in this strange narrative, the passive woman quietly staring at the window and the agitated one saying she wanted to disappear, she had clearly decided I was the oddball. "Do you have a back exit or another room I could just hide in for a bit? Then you could tell me when she's gone and I'll be on my way. And if she doesn't go, maybe we could call the police." She thought for a minute, and then, glancing out of the window and seeing the woman still standing there, looking unblinkingly in my direction, she gave me the benefit of the doubt. She showed me into the stockroom and shut the door. It was small and dark in there, and the only window was barred. It occurred to me that it was, to all intents and purposes, a padded cell. What if I'd imagined the whole thing? What if she hadn't been following me? I'd nipped out for a coffee and ended up doubting my sanity. Maybe a padded cell was just where I belonged. After a brief hiatus, the door opened and the shop assistant poked her head in. "She's gone." "Thank you so much," I said, and I waved my open bag at her to prove I hadn't stolen any slipper socks. I came out into the daylight of the shop and peered down the road. My pursuer was nowhere to be seen. I felt a surge of relief. There was a customer in the shop now, but I thanked the assistant profusely again and stepped outside. As I turned to shut the door behind me, I was just in time to catch her gesturing in my direction and mouthing a single word to the customer. Weird.
Rebecca Front was reading from her book Curious, True Stories and Loose Connections. It was abridged by Sarah Davis and produced by Gemma Jenkins. In a couple of minutes in Woman's Hour, there's an interview from the archives with Carly Simon, and they'll be taking a look at a new breed of book, Advice Manuals Written by Men for Men. I'm all ears.
The News Quiz is back. And Sandy Toksvig is in a curious mood.
I've never understood why people who play from Chelsea don't just come from Chelsea.
If they just came from Chelsea, it would be made of rugby players. I don't understand. Pick up the ball, you fool.
The News Quiz. More than I can chew. Tomorrow night at 6:30. Here on the home of radio comedy, BBC Radio 4.